help them see that it's going to be time to think differently.
Six times Jesus has started out reminding his audience that was probably up on this mountainside based on the first part of chapter 5, reminding them of what the Old Testament commanded and instructed. He reminds his audience of this, and then he follows it up with his teaching. But I tell you this, starting now with verse 43, we'll see the last of these six Old Testament. Here's how it used to be done. Here's how it's going to be done in the future. Starting with verse 43, it reads, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.'" Grant, would you like question number one? The question is, what is the original Old Testament principle that Jesus is referring to here to love your neighbor and hate your enemy?
Yes. I think pretty well agree that the first part of that, the love your neighbor, is reference back to Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, where it reads, "You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." The second part of that is certainly a little more difficult to nail down. According to the commentary I looked at, Garvey suggested that that there was not such a verse in the Old Testament, and well, that can tell there isn't either, but that it's essentially a general reference to how the Israelites had treated those around them when they initially went to the Promised Land. They were told to make war against the people there. And so it was probably more of an oral tradition that kind of got passed down. They probably had heard it said to hate their enemies, but it wasn't really a true teaching, but that's kind of what they had heard, and that's what Jesus turns around.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Anyone else have anything to add to question number one? Matt?
McGarvey says that that the hate your enemy portion was a flaw in the old law. And I know a lot of people probably are reading McGarvey because it's a good source, but I don't think that anything that anything that says that there was something wrong with the law of Moses is good to say or good to even repeat. I think that there's nothing wrong with the law of Moses. The only thing wrong with the law of Moses is the people that he gave it to. And this hate your enemy, of course, it's not in there. It's implied, I suppose, from some of the things that were told about the Canaanites. We're told that God hates that the Canaanites have idolatrous practices and that they do horrible things like kill their children and sacrifice to their gods, and that God hates that. So God is sending his judgment against them in the form of Israel. But and I suppose that, like with everything else, if Israel had taken that love your neighbor, which means Israelite in that context, you love your fellow Israelites, and you hate the things that the Canaanites do, then you will obey God and you will send his righteous judgment upon them. Of course, that's just like everything else in Jesus' name in this passage. They have corrupted that in some way, and they were even up to what Paul talks about in Galatians about the Christian Jews not eating with the Christian Gentiles. That they had a disgust for the Gentiles, and that carried through because of what they believe hate the Canaanites, the Gentiles, those people that are not Israelites, what that meant. And with the hating your enemy, well, there are several things that say to do good things to your enemy in the Old Testament. Exodus 23 says that you help your, if your neighbor's donkey run, or if your enemy's neighbor, I'm so sorry. If your enemy's donkey runs away, take it back to him. Or if it's overburdened, then you loose the straps on it. And there are several things in Proverbs that say if your enemy's hungry, give him bread or give him something to drink. If he's thirsty, don't be happy when your enemy fails or when he's in trials. And so I don't know that the hate your enemy that Jesus is talking about means that you glory in their suffering and that you are disgusted by them. It means that as Israelites, your job is to send the righteous judgment of God upon these people. And Jesus is going to say that's not necessary anymore because the judgment of God is now in his hands.
Yeah, good. And part of what I wrestled with a little bit were the passages in Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 16, talking about the destruction of foreigners. Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 through 6, there's instruction there regarding the Amorites and the Moabites. You shall not seek their peace or their prosperity. Basically, they are the enemy. So there's a balance there, but you're right. This was behavior in the past. God endorsed behavior in the past. It's changing now going forward. Anyone else? Yeah, Bart?
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. I think the distinction here is between when the Israelites were to enter into the Canaanite territories and reap God's vengeance on them, God didn't ask them to hate them in the terms of the way we hate. The issue was that they would love them. They often, as we know throughout Israelite history, that they did. They adopted their intermarried with them and adopted their habits and so on. And the point of that is that it's easy to love the world. And so God is stressing that you are to abhor the sin and separate yourself from the sin. So God never commanded anyone to hate another person. That's not something he ever did. He did command them to kill them, the Canaanites. And I thought about a couple examples in the Old Testament. David had a terrible enemy in Saul. Saul sought to kill him, and yet David was merciful to him. He never hated Saul and had an opportunity to end Saul's life, but he didn't. He respected Saul. And Jonah is another perfect example of someone who is condemned for hate. Jonah is condemned for hating the Assyrians. That's the point of the book of Jonah. He goes and he refuses to preach to them and doesn't do it willfully because he hates them because they're Gentiles. The whole point of that book is that you're not to hate the alien, the foreigner, the stranger. You're to love them. So I think we have to separate these two. And a New Testament corollary is when we're told to love Jesus and hate our families. You're to prefer Jesus and to hate your brother, your sister, your mother, or your father. When they try to pull you away from the Lord, then you have to say no to them. And that's what we're dealing with here, is you have to say no to individuals that are trying to pull you away from the Lord. That doesn't mean you actually hate them, loathe them. It means you just have to say no to them and do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. And so the Pharisees and the Sadducees had twisted this, of course, as they twisted everything. And they actually physically, emotionally hate, other individuals if they're not of Abraham. They're loathing of other ethnic origins. And that's never something God taught.
Right, very good. Lauren, you had your hand up as well.
I'll save it for the next.
Okay. Yeah, Wes?
So the first... You said in your introduction that Jesus keeps saying, but I say to you. And the first time he does that is in verse 22 when he's talking about, you've heard it said, you shall not murder. In verse 20, he specifically says, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. And then when he says, you have heard, he's talking about what the scribes and Pharisees have done, right? And so this is maybe this is a question I'm asking. But we have these examples, and Matt gave a couple where we read in the Old Testament that this audience would have known that, for example, if your enemy's donkey is suffering, you help it out, right? Bart just gave some examples. Last week when I was moderating, we talked about an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and we read several proverbs that say, do not say, I will recompense evil for evil. Do not say, my enemy should get what there is coming to them, sort of thing, right? And so why didn't Jesus just use those verses? Why didn't he say, you've seen in Exodus that you help out your enemy if they're struggling. You've seen in Proverbs that this is what you should do. Instead, he's specifically, I think, saying what the Pharisees have been spreading around, right? And when he says, you have heard it said, that's why I think some of these are not mentioned. They're not actually in the Old Testament. And he's adding that extra twist on there is what the Pharisees have added. You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. That last part isn't in the verse, right? The verse that we just read in verse 43, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, that last part's not in it. That's what the Pharisees have twisted. And so this whole thing is a commentary on what they've been hearing that they should know better And so he's not listing the other verses that we talk about because the audience already knows this. He's just reminding them the stuff that's being preached around isn't what you know.
Yeah, I appreciate
right?
you pointing that out because that is talking about the Pharisees. Very good. Austin, anyone else have any questions or comments on question number one? All right, let's look at question number two. How does this principle that Jesus is now giving shift the focus away from God's people being an earthly nation? That's verse 44. It says, "But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." Trace?
I say a lot of it's been answered for this part, but I'd say this for an earthly nation, earthly nations, obviously, when they have enemies, they try to conquer them and destroy them. And that's the best way I can understand this question. But Jesus here is telling us, you know, we are to do good to those that hate us. And that's totally contradictory to what the world would kind of do. And so that's kind of the take I took on it. And this gospel, this is also echoed in Luke, in the book of Luke. It's Luke 6:27, where it says, "But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you." Stephen, the martyr Stephen, he said before he fell asleep, it says, "Lord, do not charge them with this sin." And then he fell asleep. So Stephen also had that idea. And then we also have in Romans 12, verse 20 and 21, it says, "Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head." And then I'd also read verse 21. It says, "Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good."
Very good. Very good. Lauren.
I think this is a pretty thought-provoking question. So, last question that was asked, where did this come from? We cited Leviticus 19:18. You go back one more verse from that, it says, "You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him." So we were discussing, you know, where did the hate come from? It's not there. You shouldn't hate your brother. You rebuke him and, you know, don't go into sin with him, but you don't start to hate him. So that goes into Luke 10:29, and that's where we have the parable of what's often called the Good Samaritan. But the lawyer is asking, you know, what can you do to inherit eternal life? And he says, "Love your neighbor, love the neighbor." And then he says, "Who is my neighbor?" So now we've got this. Jesus goes into that parable of the Samaritan and shows that anybody can be your neighbor.
Right.
So in the context of this teaching, we go back just a few verses. If anyone wants to sue you, verse 41, "And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too." So that is probably addressed about a Roman soldier compelling an Israelite to go with them 1 mile. So now here it's going into who is your, don't hate your neighbor. So we're seeing that now even the Romans are your neighbor. We were connecting these two.
Yeah,
as we're talking, as Bart was talking there a minute ago, I kind of realized that this whole teaching has kind of gone back and forth between the personal and the national level. Here, you know, we have to love our neighbor. That was a personal thing, and as you were pointing out, they were told to kill their enemies who were of different origins. Now we've mingled those two within the kingdom of heaven, as Wes pointed out. And, you know, back in the verses 38 through 42, we were talking about vengeance, which was a function, a national function, and people were taking that as a personal function. So Jesus is closing this gap, showing that now it is the kingdom of heaven is, or Christianity is, everybody's included.
Yeah, very good. Anyone else? Yeah, awesome.
And thinking about this principle about the Jesus now teaching about how the Israelites are, or the people of God, should be moving away as a nation of people, as a nationality, if you will, brings to mind the fulfilling to me of Isaiah chapter 2, where he talks about how they would beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks, and that they won't lift up sword nation against nation, and they're not going to learn war anymore. So if you're suggesting to a nationality of people that now you're supposed to love your enemies, that goes against every human inclination of what it means for national security. I mean, if you were to go to the NSA or the FBI and tell them, well, now you have to love your enemies, they would laugh in your face. That's not how nations work. And so much of this teaching, and even the teaching of hating your enemy, like was said in the previous question, that was never said. It was, people implied that, the scribes and Pharisees implied that, but I believe they did so out of patriotism, which is a word that, you know, we're very familiar with. When we think patriotism, we think of America, but patriotism has been going on for a very long time, that of love of nation, right, and loving that nation so much that they conflate those who are evildoers with those who are simply of another nationality. And those two aren't always the same. So I think it, just to kind of wrap it up, Isaiah chapter 2 is really pointing forward, and I think it's fulfillment of that, his teaching here.
Good. Anyone else? Grant.
I thought that was interesting. Just to go back to Leviticus 19, that we started off, near the end of that chapter, verse 34. The stranger who dwells among you shall be to you as one born among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt, and I am the Lord your God. It's the same thing again here, where it's not just a national thing. It's the strangers who are among you, they are your neighbors as well, even if they're not really born among you.
I've read from some of the commentators talking about that word, your neighbor, and the national. It was interesting to understand the meaning and how the nation of Israel would operate. Now we have this situation where the gospel's going worldwide. There's no longer boundaries. Religion without boundaries maybe is now taking shape here. Anyone else? I had Romans 12:17 as another example of not returning evil for evil. I think that's been pointed out as well. Okay. Yeah, Russ.
Add something really quick, just thinking about what Grant just said and what Austin said. I think both of those are true, that this applies to the stranger who dwells in your land. We have a ton of verses about things like that. We've had a lot of people, including myself, speak on that topic from the pulpit recently. But I think the sort of radical expansion of that Jesus is giving isn't just be nice to a stranger in your land. He's saying love people who hate you. That's different. That's not just saying, you know, we should invite refugees in and take care of them. That's saying we should, when we have enemies who are actively hating us. And so that's the part to me that is expanding on the law and the prophets and fulfilling them that he said. And that's the part that is extremely hard to do. I think it was Barnes, maybe. I didn't note this down, but one of the commentators said that, in his view, this is the hardest thing for a Christian to do. This is the hardest teaching of Jesus to actually follow through on, because it's really difficult to love someone who hates you and to not feel the animosity towards them they feel towards you in some degree, but to do the opposite.
Yeah, very true. Anything else? All right, let's hit question number three. Why do people become our enemies and treat us badly? What does it prove to them when we do not tolerate in kind? That's verses 44 and 45, which we were at 44 already. Let's look at 45. That you may be sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. Malin, would you like this question? Did I skip Lauren? Sorry, you talked so much on the previous question. I thought it was your question. Lauren, how about the question number three?
I can skip this.
No, you got three. It's too late now.
So people become your enemies. There's, I think, a multitude of reasons why people become your enemies. Maybe it stems from something you did, intentional or unintentional. Maybe it comes from something someone else did in the past. Judgments they had against you or prejudices, maybe it's just a misunderstanding. A lot of things. The part B, what does it prove them when we do not retaliate in kind? It proves we do not hate them, that we love them, we have their best interest in mind. And though they may not understand it or recognize it, at the time, you know, it shows that we do love them. That verse we just read, like 45, it allows them to, at some time, they should be able to reflect on that and recognize that there is good, and it may lead them to glorify God and seek His love more fully. And a similar verse to what we have there in 45 is John 13:35. By this, all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another.
Very good. Very good. Anyone else? Matt?
So verse 45 is a dependent clause, which just means that it is dependent on the sentence that comes before it. And we get what that sentence means by what comes before that. So it says in 45, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, sends the rain on both of them as well. And the word that is saying, if you do these things, you will be sons of God, because God does those same things, is what Jesus is saying in not so many words. He says, if you bless those who curse you and do good to those who hate you, you're going to be doing what God does, because God does good things to people that hate Him and curse Him. And if you do those things that God does to these people who are ungrateful and unjust and horrible, then you will be children of God because you're doing what God does.
Yeah, that's right. Awesome.
I got to thinking about this, frankly, a little bit like Criminal Minds, you know, trying to get into the mind of why someone would want and feel justified in their minds of hating and doing evil to someone else. Especially when we as Christians are supposed to be ones that do good, right? And then how in turn can we, knowing that we're doing everything in our power to do good, and talking about in the verses previous, about turning the other cheek, about going the extra mile, we're doing everything in our power to make things right, even if there is some wrong that we have done, and they still actively don't like us. They still actively hate us and despitefully use us. How do we rationalize that in our minds? How do we make that okay for ourselves and not deeply desire that retaliation and deeply desire and hold in that hate and that anger? Because that's something I've dealt with just in the past. And I started thinking about it a little bit differently, and it helped me to think about it. Brett Hickey told me one time that hurting people hurt people. And I've always liked that saying, that those that are in pain themselves often lash out at other people. That's how it manifests. So thinking about that, and then because of verse 45, And what Matt pointed out, that when you start doing these things, you are doing exactly what God does. So if you look at it from God's perspective, sure, whenever we sin against God, whenever we do evil and actively do evil against God, of course there is righteous anger involved, I think. But I think another part of that, of what God's perspective is, has to be that of pity and sadness, realizing that because of the decisions that we have made, because of what we're doing against Him, He has no choice but to punish us, those that do evil against Him. And in the same way, when we're looking at people that do good or do evil to us when we do good to them and still hate us for that, how we can justify that in our minds, I think, is to think about how God thinks about it in the fact of how sorrowful of a state that they are truly in. Because you have to know that those people are miserable in their lives. If they have hate and anger and these emotions are driving everything that they're doing, they're not happy people. They're not enjoying their lives where they're at. And ultimately, their decisions will lead them to a devil's hell. And to me, that's the saddest possible state anyone could ever be in. That's the saddest thing you could ever experience. So those were some thoughts that I had on that question.
Good. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, we're going to have to get moving a little quicker here. Question number four. Are earthly possessions reflective of heavenly blessings or curses? How about this one, Malin?
Yeah. I would have taken pretty well. I don't believe so. I think what we're trying to get at here is, from verse 45, we see the passage that rains and sun shines on both the good and evil. And so, there's poor and there's wealthy people, and, both can be blessed or cursed. It doesn't necessarily have a correlation, I guess. Mainly what matters is that we use the possessions that we have to be a blessing to others and to use them to glorify God. Some are blessed with much, and some are, of course, blessed with little. But I don't believe they're related.
Yeah, good. I think you're exactly right. Anything else? Warren?
Somewhat disagree. So I think it's sometimes it is and sometimes it's not.
Sure.
So here, what we're talking about here is that sometimes it's not. But in general, blessings are more prominent for those who live a wholesome, godly lives versus reprobates, and they have many more problems. So with Exodus 20:12, obey your parents that your days may be long on the earth. So by obeying God, there is some blessings that come from that. It's not necessarily guaranteed, but same thing. Proverbs 10:4, slack become poor, the diligent rich. The other way, Romans 1:27, penalty for the error. People who practice bad stuff may get some sort of disease or something for that. So we don't really, what we consider blessings or cursings may not be apparent for us. A lot of blessings may really be a curse by God. For example, Proverbs 37:9, give me neither poverty nor riches. That's so if you have too much, it could be a curse. Too little, it could be a curse.
Yeah, very good points. Those are very good points. And it's a balance in everything, isn't it? Anywhere else? All right, let's look at question number five. In what ways do loving your enemies and doing good to those who hate you separate us from the rest of society? Lena?
I think this question has been covered already, but I'll expand. In normal society, something that comes with human nature is the feeling of wanting to get even with someone. If someone does something to you, you want to get back at them, whether or not it's in the moment or you harbor a hatred for them. And so I think in loving your enemies, you show that you do not have this human nature. You rebel against it. And when someone sees that, they're going to see that there's something different with you.
I love that answer. We're to show the world that we're different. And that's a great way not to have that attitude of hatred or ill will toward someone that's treated us wrong. Anyone else? Question number five. didn't mean to scare everybody off. We got a little more time. Okay, let's look at question number... hang on. Question number five. I read this from Kaufman, and I liked it. He suggested that Jesus' words in verse 47, "What do you do more than others?" To be one of the most interesting statements that Jesus ever made. He went on to write that Christians love more than others, will do more than others, are in fact better in every way than others. Now, that's maybe a lofty standard, but I did like the idea of him pointing out this phrase, "What do you do more than others?" I mean, I thought that was thought-provoking, maybe not to his extent, but wanted to call attention to it for everyone. All right, question number six. How can we be perfect or complete in the same way that God our Father is? That's verse 48. Verse 48, "Therefore you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect." Levi?
So I don't think this is talking about necessarily being sinless or transcending humanity and just being perfect in a way, but I think it's more maturity and not wanting to seek yourself, but wanting always to improve upon yourself and not be like self-serving.
Yeah, no, very good, very good. I in my notes, I accused Austin of this being a trick question. You know, I kind of thought, well, you can't be perfect. Anyone else on question? Austin?
Guilty as charged. I'm afraid. But to add just one verse to what he said already is just Ephesians chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. It says, "Be ye therefore followers of God as dear children, and walk in love, as Christ also hath loved us and hath given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet smelling savor." So again, not being perfect. And for a long time, that's what I thought it meant, that we had to be sinless. But if you really start thinking about that and breaking that down, we can't be sinless in the same way that God is. We can't transcend humanity, like Levi said, the same way that God is and has done and will do. So why would he give us a command that we could never fulfill? That makes no sense. So in this way, it's not that we transcend, but we're doing the same things that God does, and we are followers of him in that sense.
It's a goal. It's something that we're striving for. We know that we always have issues, but it's, like Levi said, trying to improve our service, improve our ability to worship the Lord. Matt?
The word perfect is the Greek word teleos, and when Roger Boone gave his talk at the Midmo study about biblical perfection, which of course can be found at ChristianLandmarks.com, he talked about this. He said the word perfect in the Bible, this word teleos, does not mean flawless. It never means that. That's what it means in American English, but that word means complete in all its parts or full grown. It doesn't mean without blemish or perfect in the sense that we see it. It's done. It is mature, as Levi said. It is full grown. So in that sense, we can ascend to that level that God is at, in that we see the world the way that God sees it. Not that we can ever achieve the level that God has, but that we have the same perspective and we have the same goals that God does as well. And I think that's what Jesus is saying.
Very good. Thank you. Anyone else? Lauren?
So, go along with that. In Philippians 3, 12 through 15, Paul really kind of explains that in terms of himself. Not that I've already attained or am already perfected, but I press on that I may lay hold of that for which Christ Jesus has also laid hold of me. Brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended, but one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind me, reaching forward to those things which are ahead, I press towards the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Therefore, let us, as many as are mature, have this mind, and if anything you think otherwise, God will reveal even this to you. So Paul was trying to reach perfection, working towards it. But then also, there's also the point in back up a few verses that we need Jesus to have to be truly perfect. And found in him not having, verse 9 of Philippians 3, and found in him not having my own righteousness, which is from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness which is from God by faith.
Yeah, now excellent verses. Thank you. Anyone else on this question number 6? Matt?
I actually had a question that came to my mind throughout this whole chapter that we have studied. Basically, since verse 17 through here, the fulfilling the law and what does that entail throughout these statements that Jesus says. And I thought of two questions, and one is, do the principles that Jesus teaches here differ from the principles that we find in the Old Testament? And I think that as we went through these studies, we found that everything that Jesus says is found somewhere in the Old Testament. Those principles are laid out by God. Now he detracts from some of the other aspects of it and focuses on more of the internal. I guess he detracts from the external and focuses on the internal. But the principles that we find are there. And then the second question that I had was, does Jesus make anything that we find in the old law easier? And I found the answer to that to be no. All of the requirements that are put forth here, though they can be found in the Old Testament, they're much harder when Jesus puts it to us, because they're not in sort of a legalistic list. He says it's not going to be as easy as checking off boxes.
Yeah.
It's going to be much harder than that, and that's something that I thought about just a lot when we studied this, because we miss so much of that when we argue about these passages, and that's something that really stood out to me after I looked through all of these studies that we had done.
Yeah, I like what Wes had pointed out early on, the idea that there were additions, and that's what we can see these basic teachings in the Old Testament, but it's those additional things that the Pharisees and the scribes were adding, and I think he was speaking against, calling their attention. You have heard it said. So we've been through that a lot. I think it makes a lot more sense to me. And this idea of being perfect, we can't be perfect. For us to be perfect means that we earn salvation, and we can't earn salvation. We know that. It's a gift of God. It's through grace, mercy. There's a lot to it there. Anyone else, Bart?
Yeah, I guess, and in answer to Matt's question about how can it be easier, in the New Testament, maybe the answer to that is we now have an example. You know, I learn best by example in life. I've discovered over the years that if you tell me how to do something and then set me loose, chances are I'll mess it up. But if you show me how to do it once, twice, five times, I can probably replicate what you're doing. And Jesus is that perfect example. You know, the Israelites were distant from God in some respects, Mount Sinai and, you know, crashing thunder and destruction and raining hail in Egypt and so on. There was a distance, there was no mediator. But so in a sense, even though it's a higher standard, the easier part comes from that we have a Savior who's walked the path and shown us perfectly how to do it and then motivated us by love. So I think we're at such a better place, obviously, we all know this, than the Israelites, and then we have the Messiah who's walked that path.
Anyone else? Closing comments. Appreciate it very much, everyone's participation this evening.